I want to pick up where we left off last Sunday, talking about when God doesn't make sense. And, of course, that title is a bit of a misnomer, as I mentioned before, because God always makes sense. He might not seem to make sense to us, but he obviously makes sense to himself, and that's all that really matters. But last Sunday, just to recap, talked about how hardship and calamities happen to us. We're pretty much nobody's immune from it. And when this happens, a lot of times we can't understand why it's happening or why God allowed it to happen to us. And it just doesn't seem to make sense to us that if God loves us and he's all powerful and he could stop things like that from happening, then why doesn't he do so? And we looked at how God is sovereign, spent some time looking at the scriptures in that regard. We looked at some Bible examples and also some just personal stories or stories that I heard from other people about how life isn't fair. And we've all come to realize that, I'm sure, at this point. We also looked at some biblical examples of how things sometimes happen that just don't make sense. Moses was an example of that. And we often probably are tempted to think or say that, maybe not say, but at least think, that if I were God, I would do things differently. I wouldn't do things. I wouldn't do it this way if I were him. But, you know, that's a really stupid thing to say. Just the next time you're tempted to think about, if I were God, I would do things this way, just think about when you were 5 years old and you thought, if I were mom and dad, I would do things this way, right? Because they're dumb and they don't know anything. And if they knew what I knew, they'd be doing things like I would do them. And also, of course, you're never going to go back to being five, but those of you who are employees, remember this. And an employer could tell you this. Things look differently from the employer's standpoint than from the employee's standpoint. And lots of employees say, if I were the boss, if I were the owner, I'd do things this way. He's stupid. He doesn't know what he's doing. Chances are he's not stupid and he does know what he's doing, because if he didn't, he wouldn't be in business. He would have been out of business by now. So employees have a very different perspective on things than employers do. And because most people aren't employers and most people are employees, then they don't understand that. But the next time you think about how God should do things differently, just remember those things. Remember those examples from the lesser to the greater, and then you can understand why you probably are not in a position to tell God how he should be doing things either. And then we looked at how God's timing is often too slow, how Jesus shows up 4 days late, many times in our lives. And that can be a source of disappointment or frustration or consternation, because why didn't he just show up a little bit earlier? If he would have just prevented this thing from happening, prevented me from making this bad decision, then the rest of my life wouldn't have been affected by it. Why didn't he just show up a little bit early? And I've certainly had that happen in my life. I think back to some things that happened early on, just before I was converted, that my life would have been very, very differently if Jesus would have showed up 4 days earlier, so to speak. But he didn't, and I don't know why. Probably never will. So if you have an outline, I'm down on page 5, and I want to show you some scriptures here which tell us, which should be obvious, and that is that God doesn't always tell us why he does what he does or why he allows what he allows. In the first verse we'll look at is Deuteronomy 29:29. You'll recognize this one when we get there, I think. Deuteronomy 29:29. There are some things that God tells us, some things that he reveals to us, and there are other things he doesn't tell us. He keeps secret from us. Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong unto the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the works, all the words of this law. So he's revealed plenty to us. The words of this law, this whole Bible, is God's revelation to man. And there's more in there than you'll ever totally comprehend and figure out anyway. Even of the things that God has told you, you won't even understand all that, let alone the things that he hasn't told you. So our job is just to study this word, to do all the words of this law that we can. But the other things, the secret things, they belong to the Lord our God. He doesn't reveal them to us. And there are many, many, many things probably the majority of things in life would fall into that category of the secret things. He doesn't tell you. There's lots of things about himself. There's lots of things about what's happening in the world, what's going on, things happening behind the scenes, whatever, all kinds of things that he doesn't tell you, and he's never going to. And you have to learn to make your peace with that. They're called secret things for a reason, because they're kept secret. And anybody that tells you that he can tell you what the secret things are is a fool, obviously, because you know, they're not meant to be known. Proverbs 25 and verse 2 tells us that it's the glory of God to conceal a thing. This is his prerogative. See, people don't like secrets. I mean, they love secrets when you tell them the secret. But people don't like secrets that are kept from them. We're all like this. We just have this deep desire to know the unknown. I remember just a real quick story. I don't think none of you really were privy to this, but in Minneapolis, we had this situation happen one time where these people were going to join the church. They drove a long way to come to join the church. They showed up that night and then never showed up in church the next morning and went home. And I knew what happened, obviously, but nobody else did. And I couldn't tell and wouldn't tell anybody. And I remember one member saying, "What happened with them?" I'm like, "I can't tell you." He's like, "But I want you to tell me." Like, it was just killing him. He just wanted to know so badly. And I said, "I can't. I'm sorry. I can't tell you. And I can't tell you now either." So sorry to leave you hanging. But anyway, that's human nature. It's like, oh, we just want to know the unknown so badly. And it drives us crazy if we can't find it out. But anyway, Proverbs 25 and verse 2. It says, it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. Now, this tells us that there are some things that are maybe concealed, but could be found out if you really search them out and you do your diligence. And there are some things, like the secret things, that are just flat out concealed. It's God's glory, and he's not going to reveal those things to you. And, you know, those kind of things, you would be better off just to leave them alone. Because all you'll do is end up driving yourself crazy. If you try to figure out why this horrible thing happened in my life, why did God allow this to happen to me, and you obsess about that for the rest of your life, and you're never going to find out. And you're never going to get over it either, because it's constantly on your mind. You just need to learn to let that go and just say, the Lord knew what he was doing, and he's not going to tell me why. There are some things that God does that we just can't comprehend. We just don't have the brain matter to do so. Job 11, 7 through 10. And of course, this is the way it has to be. If God is really infinite in intelligence and power and knowledge and understanding, how in the world could there not be things that we could not comprehend about him? And I know it was a double negative, but I think you got it. If he's infinite in understanding, there has to be things that we just can't understand about him. Because if we could, that would mean that we are on par with him. We're equal to him. We can understand everything he can understand. And what's that make you? A God just like he is, right? Obviously, there are going to be things that you cannot understand about an infinite, almighty, all-wise, all-knowing God. Job 11, 7 through 10. Canst thou by searching find out God? This is a rhetorical question. Obviously, the answer is no. Canst thou find out the Almighty unto perfection? So you can find out some things about the Almighty, but you can never find him out unto perfection, meaning to like a fullest extent. It is as high as heaven. What canst thou do? Deeper than hell. What canst thou know? The measure thereof is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he cut off and shut up or gather together, who then can hinder him? Right? Like in another place, you can't say unto him, what doest thou, right? You can't hinder him. You can't, whatever he decides is what he decides. You can't figure him out. You just think about it. Most of us, I mean, there's rare exceptions, but most people probably can't even understand basic physics, chemistry, biology, astronomy, like the natural sciences. I mean, most people have maybe a bit of a surface level understanding of this, but most of us, I would say probably everybody in this room, none of us would be anywhere near experts in all of those sciences, even the basic ones, let alone when you get really, really high up. So how in the world could we possibly expect to understand all the things of God when you can't understand Newton's laws of physics hardly? You know, when you're like, oh, what was the first law again? Like, How are you possibly going to understand all the ways of the Almighty? Job 37 and verse 5. Job 37 and verse 5. God thundereth marvelously with his voice. Great things doeth he, which we cannot comprehend. Right, there's your verse. We cannot comprehend the things that God does. Now, that could be in the physical, natural world. That could be in the spiritual world. That could be in circumstances that he allows into your life. There's just going to be things that we cannot comprehend. Have you ever found something that just seemed like it was just impossible, like there's just no possible explanation to this? It just doesn't make sense, and therefore, if I can't make sense of it, then it's stupid and it can't be right. And then somebody can come along and explain actually how this does make sense, and you're like, oh, I see, right? I think when we get to heaven, we're going to have a lot of, oh, I see moments when we realize, oh, there actually were reasons for all this. I just couldn't understand it. My mind just isn't big enough to comprehend those things. Isaiah 45 and verse 15. Because it really is a sign of arrogance to think, if it doesn't make sense to me, it doesn't make sense. If I can't figure it out, then it's just dumb and there is no answer. And a lot of times I think we think that way when it comes to how certain things that God does and allows in our lives. Isaiah 45:15, verily thou art a God that hidest thyself, O God of Israel, the Savior. So there are things about God that he conceals from us. He hides from us. He's revealed some to us, but he hides himself in many ways. I mean, the biggest way is physically. Like, he could make himself known to us, right? Moses saw him on the mount. He saw his backside. God could just come down and appear right now, and everybody could see him, and there wouldn't be one single person on this planet that would have any possible reason to doubt his existence if he's standing there right in front of him. And God could do that in an instant, but he doesn't. Why not? Well, he is a God that hides himself. He doesn't show us everything. He wants us to live by faith and not by sight. 1 Corinthians 2:16. But then even if he did that, somebody would say, oh, it was a hologram, it was faked, it was CGI, it was something, right? And somebody would always have something, some reason why it couldn't be true anyway. Just like Jesus said, if you believe not Moses and the prophets, neither would you believe though one should rise from the dead, right? He gave them the greatest sign ever and they still didn't believe. So even if God came down to earth and appeared to everybody, they probably, a lot of them wouldn't believe it anyway. 1 Corinthians 2:16. For who hath known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. So, in a way, we have the mind of Christ. We have a mind that is like Christ's, and we can understand the things of God. But we don't have a mind that is infinite in nature like Christ's, right? We cannot know the mind of the Lord and instruct him. We can't have a meeting of the minds with the Lord and meet him on the same plane. Though we can have, you know, we've been given through regeneration, we've been given the mind of Christ, but on a different level. And there are some things in life that we're just not going to understand and we're not going to get answers to. And the Bible tells us this. Romans 11:33. I think this can actually be comforting. If you can come to terms with the fact that there are things you're not going to know, then you can stop trying to find out all those things. But until you realize that you can't know, then you might just continue on your quest of futility. Romans 11 and verse 33. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. There's going to be some things you're just not going to find out. You're not going to get the answers to them. You're not going to understand God's ways. His ways are higher than your ways. I'll get to that verse here in a minute. But let's go back to Ecclesiastes 3:11 first. Ecclesiastes 3:11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, that is in men's hearts, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. He set the world in our hearts, in our fallen human nature, with the world in our hearts. We're not going to be able to understand God to the full. We're not going to understand the work that he makes from the beginning to the end. We're not going to see the big picture. We're not going to understand everything that he does. It just can't happen. If you could understand everything about God, that means that you've created a God in your own mind that you can understand. You've basically created a false god or an idol if you could understand everything about him. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 17. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, he shall not be able to find it. Now, if the wisest man that ever lived, except the Lord Jesus Christ, right, talking about Solomon that wrote Ecclesiastes, if the wisest man in the world said that you can labor to find it out, that even wise men can labor to find it out, and you will not be able to find it, believe him. Because if anybody could have figured out all the complexities and intricacies of life and all the reasons why God does everything he does, if anybody could have figured out, it would have been Solomon. And Solomon, after he'd done his grand experiment there, which is detailed in the book of Ecclesiastes, he came to the point where, I can't know it, it doesn't make sense to me, and life is vanity. Until he realized the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man, he said. Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 5. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God, who maketh all. Do any of us know how the bones do grow in the womb? No, you really don't. You know that the bones grow in the womb. You don't know how the bones grow in the womb. You think about that. I was thinking about it the other day. It's fascinating and mind-blowing to think that the sperm fertilizes an egg and you have a single cell, and that single cell contains the DNA of what the person is going to be. So everything the person is going to be is in that single cell. Nothing ever gets added to it. It's all there in the beginning. And then somehow that cell divides, and then each of those cells divide and divide and divide and divide. And I forget, I read just the other day somewhere that our bodies are made up of trillions of cells. And all those cells have to be talking to each other, or at least talking like to the central nervous system or something. So there has to be some kind of a communication system throughout trillions of cells in your body. And it's like, as those cells are dividing, some of those cells are becoming bone cells, and some of them are becoming blood cells, and some of them are becoming organ cells, brain cells, heart cells, arteries, veins, right? Toenails, hair. But how does all that happen? How in the world do the cells know when they divide and then they, I guess, they group together to become all these? Nobody knows how that works. It's absolutely mind-blowing. Fascinating. Well, if you can't figure out that little thing that happens every day, billions of times over, to every human being that's ever lived, if you can't even figure out that much, how are you going to know the works of God? How are you going to figure out God if you can't even figure out how the bones grow in the womb? There's just going to be things that you're just not going to understand, and neither am I. And how anybody, with any knowledge whatsoever, I mean, if you, anybody that even knows just the little bit that I just said there, which was just, you know, reasoning from somebody that doesn't know a thing about biology, anybody that even knows that much, how you could possibly believe in evolution is beyond me, to think that somehow that all evolved. That is the epitome of foolishness. Let me give you one more. Acts 1 and verse 7. Acts 1 and verse 7. And he said unto them, this is our Lord Jesus speaking to the apostles right before he ascended up to heaven, it is not for you to know the times or the seasons which the Father hath put in his own power, Now, this was in answer to a specific question about when the Lord would restore the kingdom to Israel. But the point is, the general point is, you don't know the times or the seasons which God hath put in his own power. You don't know. Those things are up to God. In this life, we see through a glass darkly. It's kind of like if you have sunglasses on and they've got all smudged up and a bunch of dirt and you can hardly see, and kind of roughly you can see, pick out some figures and things like that, but you really can't see any detail as to what's happening. That's sort of like what it's like walking through this world. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 12. We see through a glass darkly. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. This is talking about at the resurrection. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. So right now everything's hazy, everything is unclear. We can just understand a little bit here and there, but we're not going to see things clearly. Someday, maybe we will, but not now. Because God's thoughts are not our thoughts, and his ways are not our ways. Isaiah 55, 8 through 9. Isaiah 55, 8 through 9. And this is one of those verses that's easy to understand but hard to accept. It's tough to have to admit that God's ways are just different than my ways. He thinks differently than I do, and I just can't understand why he does the things he does. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. And remind yourself of that verse. Anytime you think that what God is doing just isn't right, that he has abdicated his responsibility because he's allowed something to happen that just shouldn't have happened, and this is really bothering me. You just remember, God's ways are not your ways. His thoughts are not your thoughts. He knows what he's doing, even if you don't understand what it is. And even if God did explain why he let painful suffering into our lives, we probably wouldn't understand anyway. And I'll give you an example, a bit of an illustration. Little children, they can't understand why pain is necessary for their good. Right, such as medical procedures, for instance. Take a little toddler and try to explain to him why this is necessary, why this thing that hurts is necessary. James Dobson talked about in his book, When God Doesn't Make Sense, he talked about when his son was 2 or 3 years old and he got a really bad ear infection, and it actually, like, the ear infection was attached to the eardrum, and there was like a scab on the eardrum. And his wife took the boy to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician told her that he's going to have to peel that scab off there, off his eardrum, and she was going to have to hold him down. And when she couldn't hold him down, said, "You're going to have to get your husband." And Dobson's a big man, 6'2" or something. He said 220 pounds. He comes in there and pretty much took all he had to wrap himself around this little boy and hold him down. Well, that doctor peeled that thing off, and the kid's just screaming and wailing. He said the hardest thing was for it is he could see in the mirror, and he could see his son looking at him through the mirror with this terrible, betrayed look on his face, like, "How could you do this to me? Like, don't you love me?" And it was a touching story. But anyway, if he would have tried to sit his son down and said, "Look, we have to do this because otherwise your eardrum's going to rupture and then you're not going to be able to hear when you get older and blah, blah, blah." You know what his son would have done? Wailed, right? He can't understand that. You could have explained it to him as perfectly as possible. He would not understand. All he would do is wail. And we likewise can't understand why God allows severe hardships into our lives. I have a feeling if God sat me down and explained to me why he's allowed certain hardships into my life, and just laid it out point by point logically, you know what I would do? Wail. That's what I would do. I just wail and say, "That's not right. That doesn't make any sense to me." It's the truth. Because we're like little kids, we can't understand. Just as parents pity their children and want the best for them, Even if that means allowing them to suffer pain for future benefit, God also pities us when we're suffering. Let's look at Psalm 103. Psalm 103, 13 through 14. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him. For he knoweth our frame, he remembereth that we are dust. So, God's a father, just like human fathers are fathers, and just like human fathers pity their children and would pity their child, even if he knows he's got to do this painful thing because it's best for the child in the long run, it would still hurt him to do it. God feels the same way. God pities us. God knows what we're going through. He knows that we are just dust. He knows we're weak and pitiful. And he does care. Even if it doesn't seem like it, he cares. 1 Peter 5:7, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Even if it doesn't feel like he cares, he does care. Just remember the parent-child analogy. When you're a child, you don't think your parents care. When you get old enough to understand, you realize they actually did care, right? Well, it's the same way with God. In our affliction, the Bible says he is afflicted. Judges 10 and verse 16. Judges 10:16. Speaking of Israel, and they put away the strange gods from among them and served the Lord, and his soul was grieved for the misery of Israel. His soul was grieved, even though their misery is self-inflicted here. They're in misery because they'd served other gods and they'd been taken over by foreign enemies and things like that. And even despite it being their own fault, his soul's grieved for the misery of Israel. Israel are God's people, so that applies to us today. Isaiah 63 and verse 9. Isaiah 63 and verse 9. In all their affliction, he was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his pity, he redeemed them, and he bare them and carried them all the days of old. In their affliction, he was afflicted. He feels your pain, but he allows it to go on because it's necessary. But though he feels your pain, he doesn't always explain your pain. He doesn't tell you why things are happening. But just know this, that he does know your pain. He is afflicted when you're afflicted, even if it doesn't feel like it. We'll talk about that probably. I think it's in next week's sermon about how we have to trust. We have to hold on to our faith and believe in God's promises and not look at our circumstances to determine his love for us. In Proverbs 3, 5 through 6, we're told here that we need to trust God, acknowledge he's right, and lean not unto our own understanding. And I've read this verse a million times. I've quoted it a million times. But I never really thought about it in the context in which we're looking at in this study. But it really does apply here as in many other places. Proverbs 3, 5 through 6. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. So we need to not lean to our own understanding and not try to comprehend why God has allowed these calamities into our lives. Just trust in him. Trust that he'll guide your paths, direct your paths, acknowledge him in all thy ways. Acknowledge that he's right. He knows what he's doing, and trust in him to take you where he'll have you to be. This would be the example of Joseph. You remember Joseph, the son of Jacob. Back in the Old Testament, he was a type of Christ, that is, a picture of Christ. And I'll read what Dobson has to say here about this. I thought this was a good point. He said, look at the experience of Joseph, one of the patriarchs of the Old Testament. His entire life was in shambles until the triumphal reunion with his family many years later. He was hated by his brothers, who considered killing him before selling him as a slave. While in Egypt, he was imprisoned, falsely accused of attempted rape by Potiphar's wife, and threatened with execution. There is no indication that God explained to Joseph what he was doing through those many years of heartache, or how the pieces would eventually fit together. He was expected, like you and me, to live out his days one at a time in something less than complete understanding. What pleased God was Joseph's faithfulness when nothing made sense. If you put yourself in Joseph's shoes, that would be a terribly traumatic thing to live through. When we read the story, and especially after we've already read it before, and we know what the outcome and the ending is, you can read through it and you're like, oh, okay, yeah, you get thrown in a pit, okay, yeah, but it's going to be all right. Well, yeah, you get sold to the Ishmaelites and they take you down into Egypt, but it's going to be all right. And then you go to Potiphar's house, all things are a little better for you. Oh, now you get accused of rape. Oh, now you're in prison. Now you're bound and you know, in a horrible condition, but it's going to be all right. Things are going to get better, right? And then, so, I mean, as the story goes on, you always think, well, you know, it's not such a big deal because things are going to get better. But when Joseph was going through it, he didn't know the end of the story. He had no idea. He didn't, number one, he didn't know why any of this was happening. We know why it's happened, why it happened. He didn't know why, and he didn't know what the outcome was either. It says in Psalm 105 that the word of the Lord tried Joseph while he was in prison. Psalm 105, 17 through 11. Psalm 105, 17 through 11, or 17 through 19, I don't know where that came from. 17 through 19. I wasn't really going to read backwards through like six verses or something, but although I am going to preach backwards through a passage of Scripture here one of these days, but I'm not going to read the words in reverse order or anything, but you'll see what I'm talking about. Psalm 105, 17. He sent a man before them, even Joseph, who was sold for a servant, whose feet they hurt with fetters. He was laid in iron. This is when he was in prison. Can you imagine how that would feel, putting your feet in irons, in fetters of iron, and that would be extremely painful. You're in this dark, dungy, disgusting prison, and you can't see what the end is. You don't know why you're here. You don't know if you're ever going to get out, and thinking, what have I done to deserve this? Until the time that his word came, the word of the Lord tried him. So God, the word of the Lord here is Jesus Christ. He is the word. God tried him, tested him, proved him, put him through hardship to see what he was made of. But we don't read that God ever explained his plan to him during his affliction. Nowhere are we told that. It wasn't as if God said, okay, you're in prison, but don't worry. You're only going to be here for a certain amount of time, and then I'm going to make you second in command of all of the nation of Egypt. If Joseph would have sat there and thought, what could the possible outcome be of this situation? I'm in prison now. Ah, I'm probably going to be the prime minister of Egypt here in a few months. Obviously not. He never would have thought that in a million years. Right? God never told him what the plan was. Joseph just had to trust God, even though his feet are bound in fetters of iron. Just trust God that somehow he's going to bring him through it. He only later understood God's purpose in it. Turn back to Genesis 45, 5 through 7. Now, in Joseph's case, he did eventually understand why he went through all that hardship. But in many cases in our lives, we don't. We don't get God to tell us why these things happened, like happened to Joseph. Genesis 45, 5 through 7. This is after he finally meets up with his brothers when they came to get corn because of the drought. They came up to Egypt. They didn't even know who he was. Here they are talking to the prime minister of Egypt, but they didn't realize that it was their little brother that they had sold into slavery. And he says to them, now therefore be not grieved nor angry with yourselves that ye sold me hither, For God did send me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years hath the famine been in the land, and yet there are 5 years in the which there shall neither be earing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance. See, it probably slowly was revealed to Joseph, like, oh, maybe here's the plan. When he gets taken out of the prison, and Pharaoh, he interprets Pharaoh's dream that there's going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine, and Pharaoh puts him in charge of laying up food for the 7 years of famine. I don't know if it ever crossed his mind that maybe his family would be affected by that and they would come back or not. But he starts to at least see, oh, God had a plan. Like, God's going to use me to effect a great deliverance here. And then all of a sudden his brothers show up. And I can just imagine, like, the wheels turning in his head and thinking, oh, yeah, maybe this is why they sold me into slavery. Maybe this is why I got put in prison, because I had to be there with the baker and the butler and then interpret the one's dream. And then he ends up telling Pharaoh that I can interpret dreams. Maybe this is why all this happened, so that I could get to this position and I can save my family from starvation and deliver them. Right, but this is years later, and now the pieces are all starting to fall together. But he had no idea of any of that as he was going through all that affliction. Genesis 50 and verse 20. But as for you, he's speaking to his brethren again, ye thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. But here's the thing, whether we ever find out the purpose for our suffering or not, like Joseph did, it doesn't matter, right? You just trust God that he knows what he's doing, whether he tells you about it or not. Now, here's something a point that Dobson brought out that I thought was so true. And he talked about how confusion is more difficult than pain and suffering. That it's actually, the pain and suffering is not the hardest part. The hardest part of that, going through something like that, is the confusion of not understanding why it's happening. Because if people can understand why something is happening and understand what the purpose is, human beings can go through all kinds of terrible hardship. You know, people have gone off to war and did horrible things, endured horrible things, because they understood the why, or at least they thought they understood the why. They probably really didn't understand the why, but they thought they were out there defending their country, and because they thought they were defending their country, they could do these great feats, right, and do these heroic actions because they thought that there was a purpose for it. Hasn't been the case for a long time in any of the wars we've fought for many decades, but, you know, hypothetically, anyway, you could understand the purpose for it and endure that. But if you were made to endure the same kind of suffering that you would in war, when it wasn't a war and you didn't think you were defending your country and you were just being tortured or something for no reason, right? Being made to sleep in a mud puddle and freezing weather and having your feet frostbitten and going through horrible hardship for no reason at all. I mean, most people just die. Right? But if they had a purpose in their minds and they know what's going on, then you can continue on, right? But it's when you have that confusion and you don't understand the pain and suffering, that is the hardest part. I'm going to read some quotes here from Dobson's book. He says, in fact, the majority of us will someday feel a similar alienation from God. Why? Because those who live long enough will eventually be confronted by happenings they will not understand. This is the human condition. Let me say it again. It is an incorrect view of Scripture to say that we will always comprehend God, what God is doing, and how our suffering and disappointment fit into His plan. Sooner or later, most of us will come to a point where it appears that God has lost control or interest in the affairs of people. It is only an illusion, but one with dangerous implications for spiritual and mental health. Interestingly enough, pain and suffering do not cause the greatest damage. Confusion is the factor that shreds one's faith. And that's true. I really believe that. Confusion is far more painful and hard to deal with and hard to accept, hard to get through, than the actual pain and suffering. He continues here on the next page. Jim Elliot one of the five missionaries who were spared, not spared, unfortunately, who were speared to death by the Aka, now Guarani people in Ecuador, best described this ultimate investment. He is quoted in Elizabeth Elliot's book, Through Gates of Splendor, the following, quote, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Let me read that to you again. I've heard this quote for years. I didn't know who actually said it. I didn't know Jim Elliot's story then. "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." That biblically based understanding turns martyrdom into a glorious victory. By contrast, Christians who become confused and disillusioned with God have no such consolation. It is the absence of meaning that makes their situation so intolerable. And that's it, the absence of meaning. You know, getting back to the war thing, I think that's probably why the soldiers that came back from the Iraq War, the Second Iraq War, had a crazy high suicide rate, that way more of them died of suicide after they got home than ever died in the war. And I think, this is just my idea, I think the reason for that is the absence of meaning. They got home and they realized, what the heck were we doing? That was a worthless war that we had no business being in. We went over there and massacred hundreds of thousands or even up to a million people for no reason whatsoever. And then you come home and you think, what was it all for? I did these horrible atrocities. What was it all for? The absence of meaning. Whereas when soldiers came home from World War II, right, they didn't have that. We had a defined enemy, a defined goal. You went over there, you won the war, you came home, it's over. Defeated the bad guy, right? I mean, that's the simplistic story. There's, of course, always more to the story, right? And the good guys write the history and all that. But, I mean, that was the understanding everybody had. We beat the bad guys, we came home, it's over. Not this, it hasn't been the same in these modern wars that we've been in the last 20-some years. The absence of meaning. I think that explains a lot. Anyway, it is the absence of meaning that makes their situation so intolerable. As such, their depression over a sudden illness or the tragic death of a loved one can actually be more severe than that experienced by the non-believer who expected and received nothing. So he's saying there that sometimes it's actually harder for Christians to endure these kind of things than unbelievers. Because Christians, some of them have this idea that God's going to take care of them and nothing bad is going to happen to them and everything's going to go okay because they're followers of Christ. Whereas non-believers don't have any of that. And so when the same calamity happens to a believer versus an unbeliever, the unbeliever may actually have it easier because he didn't really expect anything out of life. He just thinks, oh, this is just how life goes. Whereas the believer thought, this wasn't supposed to happen. Why did this happen to me, right? Now you have this whole crisis of faith. It is not uncommon to hear a confused Christian express great agitation, anger, or even blasphemy. This confused individual is like a little girl being told by her divorced father that he will come to see her. When daddy fails to show up, she suffers far more than if he had never offered to come. The key word here is expectations. They set us up for disillusionment. There is no greater distress in human experience than to build one's entire way of life on a certain theological understanding and then have it collapse at a time of unusual stress and pain. A person in this situation faces the crisis that rattled his foundation. Then, like little Chris, who must also deal with the anguish of rejection, Then, like little Chris, he must also deal with the anguish of rejection. And poor little Chris, this was in the book. Little Chris, if I remember, there was a lot of stories, but if I remember this one, he had been burned very badly as a little child, and his face was all disfigured, and he had to have surgeries, and he looked bad. And little kids, as cruel as they are, made fun of little Chris for looking like that. I'll try to say this without crying. And little Chris wrote a letter to his therapist. I think it was his therapist or his pastor, one of the two. Can't understand why God allowed this to happen to him. And said, God must hate me. and he must be sending me to hell because he wouldn't have done this to me if he loved me. Think about that. You know, a little kid trying to understand that. The God whom he has loved, worshipped, and served turns out to appear silent, distant, and uncaring in the moment of greatest need. Do such things come even to the faithful? Yes, they do, although we are seldom willing to admit it within the Christian community. I think he's very right about that. It's especially dangerous for anybody in the charismatic movement or in that Word of Faith movement that believe that if you just have enough faith, nothing bad is ever going to happen to you and God's going to take care of you and everything is going to be great. I think about that preacher here in town, that Word of Faith preacher that had a heart attack and then had, a stroke, and he was bedridden and paralyzed, and then he died here earlier this year, I think it was. But I just think about that and how I'm sure he had preached, if you have enough faith, you just say the word, you're going to be healed, you're not going to suffer like that. And then look at the poor guy. And what did that do to his faith? I don't know. What did that do to his family and his church's faith? You have to wonder. Now, the scripture does reveal to us, to some extent, why God allows these hardships to come into our lives. And one of the reasons is to try our faith. He does allow affliction and suffering in our lives to try our faith. So we do know that much, at least, though we may not know all the details. Let me just give you some verses here. James 1, 2 through 4. Now, I don't recommend if somebody has had a terrible thing happen, some unexpected death of a loved one or something, and they are going through a horrible time, that you put your arm around them and say, well, the Lord is just trying your faith through this whole thing. I don't recommend doing that. It's true. It's 100% true, but probably not the right time to tell them that. Just put your arm around them, cry with them, say, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. Cry on my shoulder. You can talk to me, whatever you need. But I wouldn't try to do any explanation at that point. It's not going to be helpful. James 1, 2 through 4. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. Now, temptations, these aren't temptations to sin, but temptations as in trials that God puts you through. That's the temptation has two meanings. You know, God tempted Abraham. He tempted him. He tried him. And then it also says that we can be tempted with evil. So, I mean, there are, and James talked about that in this very chapter, being tempted with evil there in verse 13. But here, you're blessed not when you're tempted with evil, but when you're tried, when your faith is tried through tribulation. Knowing this, and you'll see why I said that in this verse 3. Knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience, but let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. So, as hard as that is, it is actually something to be counted joy when you fall into these trials and temptations, because they are ultimately for your good. They do work patience in us. They do draw us closer to God. As miserable as some suffering is, I know I've gone through things and thanked God for allowing me to go through it, because it does draw me closer to Him. As painful as that is. James 1 and verse 12, blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life that the Lord promised to them that love him. Right, so there is a blessing in it, in this life even, that we will receive a crown. I mean, we're going to get the crown in heaven, but we'll also be blessed in this life for enduring the temptation. Romans 5, 3 through 5, famous verses, tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope, and hope maketh not ashamed, because the love of God is shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Ghost, which is given to us. Right, so the tribulation is there for a purpose. It tries our faith and improves our faith. 1 Peter 1 and verse 6, There are some times when temptations need to come into our lives. They can humble us. They can draw us closer to God, because you may have experienced this. You go for a while and everything's just going hunky-dory and everything's going wonderful and you're just happy and there's no problems. And what happens? You say, who is God again? I remember hearing about him before, but I haven't thought about him for a while, right? Proverbs 30. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food which is convenient for me, lest I be full and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. Right? So sometimes it is needed that we go through these trials that draw us closer to God and refine our faith. 1 Peter 1 and verse 6. Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations. So many little parts to that verse that are so important. For a season, so they don't last forever, right? They last for a season, and then God gives you a reprieve. If need be, so sometimes you need to be going through these temptations. They cause heaviness, they cause depression, they cause sorrow, and they're manifold, which means they are many, many temptations. When it rains, it pours, as they say. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth them out of them all. Psalm, I think it's 34. In the late teens there, I believe. But this trial of our faith is more precious than gold. Verse 7, that the trial of your faith, being more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So our faith is more precious than gold, and the trial of that faith is like when you try gold. When you try gold and you put it in the fire, you burn off the impurities. Well, the trial of our faith makes our faith more precious. It gets rid of all the dross and it improves it. Here's some more from Dobson. He said, apparently most believers are permitted to go through emotional and spiritual valleys that are designed to test their faith in the crucible of fire. Why? Because faith ranks at the top of God's system of priorities. Without it, he said, it is impossible to please him. Hebrews 11:6. And what is faith? It is, quote, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Hebrews 11 and verse 1. This determination to believe when the proof is not provided and when the questions are not answered is central to our relationship with the Lord. He will never do anything to destroy the need for faith. In fact, he guides us through times of testing specifically to cultivate that belief and dependence on him. Hebrews 11:6-7, which is the verse that says that Enoch pleased God, and without faith it's impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. He said in another place, our message boils down to this very simple understanding. There is nothing the Lord wants of us more than the exercise of our faith. He will do nothing to undermine it, and we cannot please him without it. To define the term again, faith is believing that which has no absolute proof. Hebrews 11:1, which is faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. It is hanging tough when the evidence would have us bail out. It is determining to trust him when he has not answered all the questions or even assured a pain-free passage. And then in another place he said, the biblical account tells us, quote, about the fourth watch of the night he cometh unto them walking upon the sea. Mark 6:48. I changed the text. He was using another version. I changed the text to King James. From the early evening to the fourth watch is a seven-hour passage of time. For 7 hours, Jesus watched the disciples do battle with a severe headwind before he came to assist them. Yet they were in his vision and under his care throughout the night. Obviously, he permitted them to experience their need before coming to their rescue. And I hadn't really thought about that passage all that much until he brought that out. Jesus is on the mountain and he's watching them all night long until the fourth watch, and they're out there toiling and rowing. He sees them for 7 hours. And then he walks on the sea out there and calms the sea. He could have done that the first hour, but he let them toil for 7 hours out there in a rough storm at sea. Why did he do that? Well, to try and prove their faith, test their character. Now, sometimes our troubles are due to our own sin and foolishness. Most of what I'm talking about in this study are things that are not due to our own sin and foolishness, but it is true that there are plenty of troubles that we do endure that are our own fault. Ultimately, all suffering, sorrow, trouble, and death are due to sin. That's really where it all comes from, of course. It goes back to the Garden of Eden. When Adam sinned, he brought sin and death upon all his posterity. And you remember that in Genesis 3:6. I'm not going to read the passage, but his wife gave to him and he did eat, right? They saw that it was good for food and desire to make one wise and so on. Adam intentionally disobeyed God. He ate of the fruit. God told him, in the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. There's a change comes over Adam, and then God pronounces the curse on him, and he says, the ground's cursed, your labor's cursed, by the sweat of your brow you're going to labor. So when Adam sinned, he brought the curse upon himself, he brought sin and death upon himself, and it says in Romans 5:12 that wherefore as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so that death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. So Adam passed that sin/death principle down to all of us, and that's why all of us eventually get sick and die in this world. And that's why we suffer all these calamities, is because of sin entered into this creation. And we're told in Romans 8:20 through 23 that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth together in pain until now. So even the animals are suffering because of what Adam did. And we're told in Romans 6:23 that the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. Wages of sin is death. The thing is, it comes sooner to some than others, right? And that's how you can explain what happens in this world. Everybody gets death. Everybody deserves death. The wages of sin is death. Some people just get it earlier than others. Some people die as a child. Some people die in midlife. Some people die, you know, before they reach their full age. Some people get killed in tragic car accidents. Some people get cancer. Some people have heart disease. Right? Some people, all kinds of stuff. Some people get murdered, right? Poor Abel. I mean, he didn't even make it past the second generation. Got murdered, right? So some people's death just comes earlier than others. And the only way that I can explain that is Ecclesiastes 9:11 and 12. Sometimes innocent people are like the unfortunate fish that get caught in the evil net. Now, of course, God understands everything. God knows why each individual person suffers as he does, and he knows why some people die in infancy and some people live to be 90, and so why some people, you know, die in tragic circumstances and others just live out a nice peaceful life and lay down one night and don't wake up the next morning. God knows why all these things are, but we really don't. And here's the best explanation that I can give you as to why some die early, why some suffer, and why some don't, or at least as much. Ecclesiastes 9:11-12. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. Time and chance. Sometimes it just, God just, at least from our perspective, just allows certain things to happen to certain people, and they just, it was their time. There's no rhyme or reason to it. They just, something bad befell them and it didn't befall the next guy. Verse 12. For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falleth suddenly upon them. You know, you get all these fish in the sea, and it just so happens they drop the net down and pick it up, and there's 153 fish in that net, like when the disciples were fishing. Why did one of those fish end up in that net and the other one ends up going free? Time and chance happeneth to them all. I don't know. I mean, God knew where the little fish was and he put them there. But from our standpoint, he just got caught in the evil net. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. There might not be a specific sin which caused a person's suffering or calamity or death. It might not be, there's no direct correlation. You did this, therefore you died early. You did this, therefore you got that disease, right? In some cases, they're just part of the collateral damage of a sinful world. That's the best way that I can understand it. You're just collateral damage. It just happens. Some people are just going to end up suffering more than others, and it just might be your lot. That's all. But sometimes hard times fall on people as a result of their own sin. Like, it actually is their fault. Psalm 107 and verse 17. Fools are afflicted because of their sin. So it's important to keep this fact in your mind too, as you're thinking about why, when God doesn't make sense and why he lets these things happen. It's always a good idea to do an inventory of your life. I mean, you know, if you drink a 30-pack every night, and then in a few years from now you say, I've got cirrhosis of the liver. What were the odds? Why did this happen to me? Why is God so cruel and unmerciful? Why am I dying of liver cancer right now? You always might want to just look in the mirror, have a little introspection, and think, I did drink 30 beers every night. That might have something to do with my cirrhosis of the liver. Maybe God's not some big meanie after all. Maybe I'm just an idiot. Right? So there is always that. You always want to consider that maybe it is actually my fault. And be honest with yourself, because plenty of times it is actually our fault. Psalm 107 and verse 17. Fools, because of their transgression and because of their iniquities, are afflicted. So this does happen. You sin, you get afflicted. We're told in Proverbs 13 and verse 15 that the way of transgressors is hard. Proverbs 13 and verse 15. Good understanding giveth favor, but the way of transgressors is hard. If you're going to sin, especially against better knowledge, you're going to have a hard life. That's just the facts. That's why it's good to chasten children and beat that foolishness out of them before it gets ingrained in them and they have a hard life. Sin brings forth death. Remember Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death. James talked about when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and when sin is finished, it bringeth forth death. Sin has natural consequences. It doesn't take much imagination to see how the following sinful or foolish things will lead to suffering and death at times. Now, as I read through this list, just think about it. You probably wouldn't have to think really hard. Think about how each of these things could lead some just outright to death, or some at least to suffering. Just think about it. Abortion, fornication, adultery, sodomy, rage, disrespecting spouses, disrespecting bosses, disrespecting police. I just thought of that one. Disrespecting parents, marrying the wrong person, not disciplining children, going into debt, excessive drinking and eating, drugs, smoking, foolish decisions, and reckless driving. Right? Any of those things. Right, you can easily see how some of them would straight up lead to death through diseases, STDs, getting the crap beat out of you because you can't keep your mouth shut, right? Having a woman's husband kill you because you committed adultery with his wife, reckless driving, right? All those things, excessive drinking and drugs. I mean, it's easy to see how those things can lead to death, right? And the other things can certainly lead to a lot of suffering, if not death, in the long run. Dobson wrote, I believe many of the trials and tribulations that come our way are our own making. Some are the direct consequences of sin, as we have seen. In other cases, the pain we experience is a result of unwise decisions. We make such a mess of our lives by foolishness and irresponsibility. When one considers the range of sheer nonsense that human beings can generate, it is understandable why author Mark Twain once said, quote, at times, it does seem a shame that Noah and his party didn't miss the boat, unquote. You get what he's saying, right? If Noah and his party would have missed the boat, we wouldn't have the plague of humanity upon this earth to screw everything up. Now, here's the thing that happens with fools. When they do stupid things, then they often complain to God about why he has allowed this terrible calamity to come into their lives. Proverbs 19 and verse 3. Proverbs 19:3, the foolishness of man perverteth his way, And he admits that he was wrong and says, I really screwed up and I shouldn't have done that, and asks God for mercy. Nope. And his heart fretteth against the Lord. Yep. He was the one that did the foolishness and the stupidity and perverted his way, and now he frets against God. He gets mad at God. Why did you allow this to happen to me, Lord? They wonder why God doesn't make sense, but they fail to see that they don't make sense. They don't make sense. It's not God that doesn't make sense. When you do stupid, foolish things and you suffer for it, it's not God that doesn't make sense. It's you that doesn't make sense. All right, let me just finish the rest of this. Feeling forsaken by God. I'll try to go through this briefly since we are short on time. But if I save it till next Sunday, then we're going to be short on time next Sunday because I've got a full sermon there and I don't have enough for two more, I don't think. So when experiencing suffering, affliction, loss, sorrow, or troubles, it's not uncommon for Christians to feel like God has forsaken them. David asked God how long he would forget him and hide his face from him there in Psalm 13 and verse 1. And when you read through the Psalms, you'll see a lot of this, where David and other psalmists are questioning God, like, why has he left them? It seems like he's not there. Psalm 13, 1, how long wilt thou forget me, O Lord, forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? The man after God's own heart, and he's feeling like God's forgotten him and hidden his face from him, and he doesn't know if God's ever going to appear again for his help. God will hide his face from us in times of trouble. Psalm 30 in verse 7. Lord, by thy favor thou hast made my mountain to stand strong. Thou didst hide thy face, and I was troubled. See, God can give favor and make your mountain stand strong. You'd be doing great, and all of a sudden he hides his face, and now you're in trouble. And sometimes he does that to humble you. I've talked about that. Talked about that in the anxiety series, I believe. Asaph wondered if God would cast him off forever, being favorable to him no more, and forget to show him grace and mercy in Psalm 77, 7 through 9. So this is not an uncommon feeling. You know, the biblical writers felt the same thing. They felt like God had just cast them off and didn't want anything to do with them anymore. Psalm 77, 7 through 9. Will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah. Of course, we know in our heads that the answer is no. Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Well, obviously not. But it feels like that. We really begin to wonder, like, maybe he has just totally forgotten about me. Dobson said, when the heat is on and confusion mounts, some believers go through a horrendous spiritual crisis. They, quote, lose God, unquote. Doubt rises up to obscure his presence, and disillusionment settles into despair. The greatest frustration is knowing that he created the entire universe by simply speaking it into existence, and he has all power and all understanding. He could rescue. He could heal. He could save. But why won't he do it? This sense of abandonment is a terrible experience for someone whose entire being is rooted in the Christian ethic. Satan then drops by for a little visit and whispers, he's not there. You're alone. That's a great time for Satan to tempt you too. When you're going through suffering and it feels like God's not there and he doesn't care, and then Satan says, come on. He doesn't believe. He's not there anyway. Right? All these unbelievers suffer just like you do. You're suffering just like they are. What's the difference? Right? If God's really there, if God really loves you, why would he let this happen? God will sometimes leave us for a time to see what's in our heart. He doesn't leave us forever, but he'll leave us for a time. He did this with one of the kings of Israel, Hezekiah, I believe it was, in 2 Chronicles 32, 31. But he doesn't just do it to be cruel. He does it for a purpose. He wants to prove us, to see what's there, see if we love him or not. 2 Chronicles 32, 31. Howbeit in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him. He's talking about Hezekiah. God left him to try him that he might know all that was in his heart. So sometimes he will. He'll prove us to see whether we'll believe him or not. Deuteronomy 8 and verse 2. Because, you know, it's real easy to be faithful to God and to sing God's praises and to say how wonderful the Lord is when everything's going just great in your life. But then all of a sudden when things start to not go great and things get really bad, then God's going to see what you're made out of, and so are other people. Are you going to keep the faith? Or are you just going to throw up your hands and say, "Man, you know what? Believing in God, following God has done nothing for me. What's the point?" Deuteronomy 8 and verse 2. "And thou shalt remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness to humble thee and to prove thee and to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldest keep his commandments or no." See, he had a purpose for that 40 years and all that hardship that they endured. To prove them, to know what was in their heart. See if they were going to be faithful or not. But though God will leave us for a time to prove us, he will not utterly forsake us. And the psalmist prayed this in Psalm 119 and verse 8. Psalm 119 and verse 8. "I will keep thy statutes," the psalmist said. "Oh, forsake me not utterly." And he won't. Isaiah 54, verses 7 through 8. Isaiah 54, 7 through 8. "For a small moment have I forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith the Lord, thy Redeemer." See, he might forsake you for a little moment. He might hide his face from you for a little bit, but not forever. And with everlasting kindness, he will have mercy. Sometimes we pray and pray and pray, and it doesn't seem like God hears our prayers. But God does hear them, even if it doesn't feel like it. Remember 1 Peter 3:12, that the ears of the Lord are open unto the prayers of the righteous, we're told. He hears them. He might not just answer them in the affirmative always, but he hears them. He knows our sorrows, even if it doesn't seem like it. This was said of Israel when they were suffering under the Egyptians in Exodus 3 and verse 7. Exodus 3:7. "The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, and I know their sorrows." But you know, they suffered under those taskmasters for a long time before the Lord delivered them. But he knew their sorrows. He was just allowing that temptation to run its course, to prove them. God considers our troubles and knows our souls in adversities. Psalm 31 and verse 7. Psalm 31 and verse 7. "I will be glad and rejoice in thy mercy, for thou hast considered my trouble. Thou hast known my soul in adversities." See, the times where we feel forsaken by God, he's actually there and closer to us than ever. He knows us more intimately and personally when we're going through those things. And sometimes those are the times we feel like he's the furthest away, and those are the times when he's actually the closest to us. It says in Psalm 34:18 that God is nigh unto the brokenhearted. Psalm 34:18. "The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart, and saveth such as be of a contrite spirit." So he actually is near. Nearer to you than probably at other times when you're feeling well. When you're actually brokenhearted and of a contrite spirit, the Lord is never closer to you. "And his mercy is great toward them that fear him," it says in Psalm 103:11. This will be the last verse for today. Psalm 103 and verse 11. "For as the heaven is higher than the earth," "for as the heaven is high above the earth, so great is his mercy toward them that fear him." we can't comprehend how much higher the heaven is from the earth, right? Well, so great is God's mercy toward us. Incomprehensible, the amount of mercy that God has toward them that fear him. So no, you're not forsaken by God when you're going through hard times. Even if it feels like it, you're not. God is always there. He's always nigh. And you just got to hold on to your faith. And eventually, you'll come through it and you'll realize that he was there all the time. And you'll realize that through that situation, you were drawn closer to him than you had been before. So next time I want to finish up, Lord willing, I want to finish up this study. And I think the best is yet to come. I think some of the most important part of this study is in next week's installment when we go through like how to answer some of these questions and how to deal with these situations when they do happen. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.